I'm Kareem Ray, your host at the One Soccer Nation podcast. And today I have the pleasure of interviewing Ian Budge, who is the executive director at Omnia Sports Group. Ian, thank you so much for taking the time today. How are you doing?
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, good. Pleased to be here. I'm in a slightly damp and slightly wet Miami. If I kind of move out of the way here, you probably can see the backdrop of the grass behind me. But yeah, all good. So we have a conference here in Fort Lauderdale tomorrow for International Women's Day. Flown in this week from London. So it's an exciting time. We're going to launch our 2024 kind of series tomorrow. Life's good. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So you're probably jet lagged from the flight.
Well, my wristwatch has still got the time from home, so I kind of know when to check in with the wife and my son. I'm not really sure what time it is or when I should be eating certain foods, you know. So we're good. We just roll with it. It was good.
Yeah. So what is Omnia Sports Group?
Okay, good question. So Omnia Sports Group's a collection of businesses, a grouping of businesses. The kind of golden thread that runs through all of them is sport for social change. So I know this is a soccer podcast, and you know, from our perspective, soccer in the UK, the biggest sport. We use sport for social change. So we've got five subsidiaries, and you know that those kind of thematics around media, education, community. Recruitment for the industry, effectively making sure that those gaps that the industry have, that people, particularly young people, are skilled enough to be able to attain those roles and those jobs. But the kind of really shop window kind of sexy stuff, so to speak, is Omnia Media, and we have two brands: Everything in Sport and Power Play the Future. We'll talk a little bit more about the Power Play. Kind of in due course, but those grouping of businesses, the idea is to use that sort of collection of businesses all around sport for social change. So whether that's education in our local communities, we have a school, a foundation for young boys who are 12 to 16 years old who have social and emotional difficulties or autism spectrum disorder, and we use sport as the kind of hook really to engage them in education. These young people have fallen out of the education system, invariably in most of the places that they've been, quite distrustful of the system per se. Dare I say, the system doesn't quite understand them. So, that's a really big part of our business. And Omnia, the name meaning everything in Latin, but Omnia is kind of came from them, means open-minded, noble, independent achievers. And for us, that being able to use sport and part of tomorrow really is about trying to get the people in the room that can kind of challenge and do something about some of the ills and the social ills that we have in society, and the sport being a vehicle for that change. It's an exciting time. We're going to Montreal in June, London, sorry, in May, Montreal in June, and Oslo in September. And all of our events this year are all based around our women's editions. And we plan to, go to other parts of the world, which I'm sure we'll cover sort of in due course. But yeah, that's kind of in a nutshell who we are and what we do.
Understood. Could you share with us the pivotal moments that led you to your current role as an executive director at Omnia Sports Group?
Yeah, so I didn't always fly to Miami and sit here in my favorite, although if you can kind of see this one, AC Milan, Ruud Gullit shirt from back in the day. You know, I was a teacher in a shirt and tie for 20 years. In the UK, that would be post-16 education. I suppose in the US, it would be kind of end of high school. I've always kind of passionately believed in sport. I had a relatively stable, normal, so to speak, supportive sort of upbringing. And sport taught me so much and opened so many doors for me and helped me become, you know, a relatively kind of rounded person. And then being in and around education, as I say, for 20 years, my previous job, I was a deputy principal at a large college in London, one of the biggest colleges in the UK. And it showed me the other side of society, people that don't live in supportive homes, that have, you know, huge barriers, whether it's, you know, poverty or emotional or learning difficulties. And as we all know, over the last few years, COVID particularly exacerbated and sharpened that experience for a lot of those young people. I was also a magistrate in the UK. I was a magistrate for 7 years. So again, seeing a certain type of individual come into court, normally drink or drug afflicted, you know, mental health challenges, etc. And so I've always kind of wanted to be involved in sort of public service and doing stuff that feels like it has value and has meaning. And you know, I think the opportunity to do what I do now and work in a sports group and try and, you know, work to make sport safe and to operate in safe places and, you know, to be a bit more equitable and, you know, whether it's, as I say, I've mentioned crime, but crime divergence, but it's particularly for young people, you know, they're 30% of the world's population, but 100% of our future. I have an 8-year-old. I want him to surround himself with sport and make friends and learn how to be a good person. But again, what I saw a lot of the time in the education sector is, if you sort of imagine that young person at the center of a spider web, what kind of all them strands, I suppose, that come off that spider web in terms of their support mechanisms, some of them don't have very much. And there's a lot of people out there that are quite keen to cut those ties and pull them towards crime or pull them to a certain type of living that perhaps is not going to be kind of advantageous for them long term. So I think for me, being able to, you know, operate in a space, bring brands together, you know, rights holders, broadcasters, sports, governing bodies, federations, etc., bring them together and actually be a bit kind of anarchic, I suppose is the word, or a bit kind of disruptive in a positive way, but and try and get change out of it, out the back end. So, you know, for me, I suppose, you know, what society do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a society where those barriers for young people in life in general are kind of reduced or equalized? You know, I understand my privilege. I'm white and I'm male, and that opens certain doors that right from the get-go others don't have. So, you know, that life feeling pretty inequitable for people, you know, whether it's gender, race, your education level, the way you talk, feels a bit a haphazard in terms of your access to being able to kind of get on in life and have access to opportunities, even kind of get your voice heard in the room. So, you know, to iron some of those wrinkles out is I suppose it's kind of what I've learned. But I mean, we, you know, I need to pay the bills. We all need to pay the bills in our life, right? But being able to do that and feel like you're actually being able to do something that makes a difference within your community, with, you know, within sport, something that I'm particularly passionate about, is you know, I feel very fortunate to be able to do that.
Absolutely. You mentioned your passion for sport. Where does your passion come from?
Well, my dad was sports mad, absolutely sports mad. I had, just like probably a lot of people, you're influenced by the people that are around you. I had two older brothers, an older sister, that again, all interested in played sports at kind of various levels. But for me, it was teachers at school, you know, hugely passionate, got me involved in sports I never tried before, things that I never knew I could or couldn't do. Sometimes I didn't even want to play them, but you know, if you wanted to play soccer and you want to play for the soccer team, you had to kind of go and play all these other sports that, as I say, I'd never done. And I never picked up a basketball until I was kind of 11 years old, because it was just football mad. You know, rugby, athletics, pole vault, throwing the discus, never done it. So for me, going to secondary school, you know, at the age of 11 here in the UK, and then progressing through college, and then into university, I did a and some nice degree, a master's degree as well after that. And I just love what sport gives people. And that's not necessarily why they play it. My 8-year-old doesn't go and play rugby on the weekend because of any other reason than he loves it. Doesn't probably understand or can probably verbalise why he loves it. And he's a terrible person in the mornings, can't get up at all. But rugby is the only time he's up and ready and changed. He'll walk around in a mess. I'm on a messy shirt. I'm under strict instructions to get him a new messy shirt from this trip. But we recently got back. I took him to Paris to go and see the PSG stadium. And the sport means so much to children. A lot of those people don't sign up to be sports stars. Don't sign up to be role models, but they get it and they inherit it. And it means so much to young people. But for me, everything was around sport, soccer particularly. My dad come from South London and supported Millwall, which not many of your listeners probably would have heard of, or only probably heard of for the wrong reasons, for hooliganism back in the sort of 70s and 80s. But it was the football club, and it still is, and I'm sure it's the same all over the world, but the football club is part of the community. It's the heart of the community. It brings people together. And I loved being part of a team. I loved working with kind of other people. I think as I got a bit older and got a bit fatter and my knees didn't work and all the other kind of bits and pieces that happen to you, I think I loved the change room just as much as playing the sport and kind of, having a good time with my friends. I suppose for me, being able to do what I do work-wise, but try and ensure that young people are surrounded by other good people, good coaches, other parents, supportive environments, because they might not get that at home. That might be the only place that actually someone cares about them, someone's interested in them, and it's a huge part of societal change for me. If anyone listening's not found out much about Millwall, we're not doing particularly great in the Championship in England at the moment. So I need all your prayers and love for Millwall.
Got it. I mean, you've mentioned it so many times. It's about sport is so powerful that it can have a positive effect on children and keep them on a positive path. As that's what soccer did for me. It kept me out of trouble. It kept me away from a lot of the dangers, from a lot of the bad stuff. And it's such a powerful vehicle to bring people from different cultures and backgrounds all together in the same place and kind of speak the same language with the ball. So I really want to just highlight, you've mentioned good sports producing good people. And you could see, I'm not too sure about other sports, but soccer really expanding to a lot more countries and a lot more places in the US, all over the world. With saying that, I want to go back to the women's side of it as well. Women's sport, women's soccer, women's football, has become very popular. It's a really big conversation now, and especially on the investment side. With the event coming up tomorrow, what is the goal for tomorrow's outcome?
Well, that's a really good question. I think some of my colleagues went to a conference in Oslo recently, in Norway, and the title of the conference, roughly sort of translated in Norwegian, which I can't speak, what do we want from women's sport? Do we want just like a low fat version of it, of men's sport? Or, what actually is it? Is it going to be its own thing in its own right for its own abilities and for what it is and what we watch and what we see? Or are we just trying to fit women into a men's system? So I think out of tomorrow with the launch for our 2024 series, I think in an ideal world, what we do wouldn't exist, but we don't live in an ideal world. Sport is unequal. Women in society is unequal. They have more than 50% of the world's population, but they don't have access to the safe spaces. They don't have access in terms of a curriculum that might exist within their country. It's considered women kind of slotting into a man's world. You've only got to kind of go on social media and Twitter or X as it's known, but and look at some of the vitriol that kind of comes out in relation to women's sport. So for us, it's, you know, again, be a bit anarchic and a bit disruptive. But it's actually, you know, how do we reduce the barriers for women to be involved in sport? And that's not just playing sport, you know, the numbers of coaches. I mean, the Olympics is a great example. 2024 Paris is coming up, and they've made a big song and dance that 50% of the people performing are male and female. Fantastic. But it's about 15% of the coaches are women, you know, so we've still got so much further to go, you know, and from our position about just trying to amplify stories and lived experience of women within sport, and how we can kind of work together, which sport isn't particularly good at. We kind of operate within sport silos. So soccer does its thing over here, rugby over here, athletics over here. We don't tend to collaborate or talk or interact very much. So being able to kind of bring people to in the room that are prepared to collaborate, have the will to collaborate, want to kind of move things forward, you know, and that for me is, you know, that for me is really what it's about. It's trying to find people that want to do something about it, can do something about it, should do something about it, want to collaborate, because actually that kind of Venn diagram of the work that they do and the work that somebody else might do, there's always overlap. But I mean, the important thing for me is that a women's conference and a women's edition, the four events that we do this year, yes, it's about amplifying, but we don't need a room of women. Women don't need to be told about the issues perhaps that exist in society, not just sport, but within society. We need people that can do something about it, and we need change makers, and we need the people that are making decisions, whether that's kind of at elite levels of sport all the way down to the kind of grassroots of sport. Often those positions are held by men, and, you know, there's nothing wrong as a man providing, you know, I don't really like the word allyship, but, you know, allyship, if you're going to use it and term it in that way, it needs to be something strategic, needs to be something organized, institutional. You know, and if you're, you know, if it was a women's sport edition, or if it was about black and ethnic minorities, or if it was around religion or culture or whatever it was around, everybody can have a play a role in that. It isn't up to women to sort out the women's sport space. It's a collective endeavor. So yeah, again, you know, for me, I think it's a case of trying to bring people together tomorrow. You know, we're going to hear some fantastic stories. It's all kind of free to stream, but we're going to be in a position to, you know, hear from people about their own lived experience and what that has actually meant for them within sport, but what we can do about it, and try and get some collective kind of will in the room to kind of move forward. Because we have to face facts. I mentioned earlier around a brand that we have called Power Play, and Power Play for us is around kind of female founders within that tech space, and kind of trying to link them up with investors. And you've only kind of got to scratch the surface at that and see how many female founders, whether it's kind of seed ideas or pre-seed or concept ideas, that they just can't get in the room. They can't get in the room with people that have the pockets to do so. But conversely, the people that have got the deep pockets, you know, circa 3 to 5% of those people are women, the rest are men. So, you know, trying to level the playing field, trying to provide some equity. I mean, the theme for International Women's Day tomorrow is inclusion worldwide. And, you know, that's probably a good place to kind of leave that there. But, you know, as in, you know, it's a question for all of us within everything that we do in every, you know, work, professional, social lives, etc. How inclusive actually are we? Or do we just keep perpetuating the same things that people before us have done? So it's important to be a bit anarchic and ask some questions.
Absolutely. I'll just share quickly. So the One Soccer Nation logo there, it's black, white, and blue. I actually want to change the blue to pink and get a female professional player to interview more women within the space of soccer. I've interviewed a few women on the podcast myself, you know, anywhere from players on field to front office. But again, what you mentioned about inclusion is so important, and we definitely want to incorporate that more into One Soccer Nation, especially on the podcast side. So I really appreciate the works that you guys are doing. And you know, collaboration and inclusion is always important. With saying that, What unique challenges have you encountered in the sports industry, and how have you navigated through them in your career?
So I mentioned earlier about having sort of, you know, having sort of privilege. I'm aware of that. You know, I don't want to sound too kind of too sort of liberal and kind of wishy-washy, but, you know, it is what it is, right? And I think in terms of the sector in general, like I said, the sports sector, the challenges of providing safe spaces for children, barriers to access, you know, money, resources, facilities. But like I say, the sector's attitude towards equality and equity and safeguard, you know, they're all huge challenges. They continue to be huge challenges. So in the UK, I'm not too sure around sort of North America, but nearly every single sport, and if it hasn't happened already, it's coming down the pipe. But, you know, the safeguarding scandals of people that have maneuvered and got themselves into spaces to have relatively easy access to children for their own sort of sexual gratification, it's huge. And sports kind of, what are they doing, and how do they intend to kind of ensure that young people particularly are safe within sport? So, you know, whether that's kind of coaches, et cetera. But I think in North America and perhaps in Europe, that, you know, I'd probably say that things are probably a little bit more advanced than perhaps where we'll find the safeguarding kind of scene within Asia and Africa. At this conference in Norway, as an example, we heard from some people from Mali talking about basketball and their experience. It's the biggest sport in Mali, and the dream, you know, to become professional and move to the NBA and have earn some money, maybe for them and their family, life-changing money. But the, you know, people, because the net has tightened quite a lot in Europe and in North America in relation to safeguarding, people moving to those places where there's slightly less regulation. You know, so I think that in terms of a challenge is huge. Like I say, I worked in education for 20 years, and seeing the sharp end of safeguarding people's environments at home, how they're treated, the life that they have, how society cares for those individuals, how we can use sport and education particularly as a way of keeping those people safe. So I think from a challenges perspective, safeguarding, we've got Eleanor Rowland tomorrow coming from Fulham Football Club, used to work, has had a huge kind of career within safeguarding. The Fulham have a shared owner with the Jacksonville Jaguars. So, you know, actually collaborating and working with other sports. And it isn't just about the players who particularly young players who are coming through the system, but, you know, how are people, what was their experience like on match day when they go to a stadium? So safeguarding is and continues to be huge, and sports can either be kind of proactive, and the federations can either be proactive and kind of get their ducks in a row around what they're going to do. Or they can react to individuals, particularly individuals, is always the wrong way to go. You know, being able to be proactive and plan for some of these kind of things and these scandals happening, perhaps because the safeguarding kind of landscape wasn't particularly tight in the 1970s and 80s. And in the UK, we've seen big scandals in swimming, women's football. I know there's been some stuff in North America around Canadian hockey players and stuff. So, you know, it affects every sport, and that continues to be a challenge. But, you know, like I say, collaboration has to be the key here. So if you look at soccer invariably has got relatively deep pockets. A good example in particularly in the UK is the higher profile female soccer players suffering from ACL injuries, anterior cruciate ligament injuries. Why does it happen? What's leading to that? Is it the boots? Is it the surface? Is it the training load? Is it the hormonal period of a woman's cycle that's contributing to that? I'm not sure that we really know. There's lots of kind of literature out there. But you dig a little bit deeper and you realise actually the vast majority of boots that have been made by companies were designed around white men's feet. you know, from back in back whenever, right? You know, newsflash, not everyone's white and not everyone has the same feet as those people in the 50s. So, you know, so those big brands, Adidas and Puma and Under Armour and Ida, big, you know, as good examples, are kind of operating in that space around female boots. But if you take a sport in the UK that doesn't have a great deal of investment, not huge kind of TV deals, netball, and I'm sure you could probably think of others from kind of North America. ACL injuries in netball in the UK has the incident rate and the surgery rate afterwards is higher than it is in soccer. You know, so the money that the NFL here in kind of North America and football and soccer, sorry, in the rest of the world, you know, they're doing their research. But does that research actually filter down to other sports? And does it also filter down to the grassroots? So, you know, so somebody who, you know, as an example, a friend of mine is in her mid-30s, you know, being able to go and play netball in the week, you know, leave the children, leave bedtime routine to somebody else, get out, have fun, be with her friends, enjoy herself. You know, that person, if they injure their ACL, is not having an MRI scan and surgery the next day like you would in a professional kind of game and environment. That person will be waiting for surgery. That person won't be able to access sport for a period of time. Women are 25% less likely to come back after an ACL injury than men. You know, so holding on to this information, I totally appreciate there might be a commercial aspect to doing it, but from a social change and social good perspective, you know, that as an example, we aren't going to be in a progressive kind of sport space if we keep all this information to ourselves. You know, concussion in the NFL, particularly in rugby, us now, I don't know if you've seen like smart gum shields that are being used now to detect and kind of indicate a colour about whether somebody might have suffered a head injury, because, you know, I'm sure you've been in that space. You know, you've got a whack the last sort of 10 minutes of a game. You don't want to come off and fine. That decision needs to come out of the player's hands. You know, often the coach doesn't make the best decision because they need that player on the field. But, you know, that is required quite a lot of investment, you know, from a tech perspective. But actually, how we treat concussion, how we work with people pre-concussion, about, you know, how do we work with teammates to recognize concussion? How do we treat people afterwards? Does that actually filter down to some of the sports that don't have it? So I think that there's so many unique challenges. You open any newspaper on any particular day and you look at the sports section, and there's always something, you know, whether it's kind of from a regulation perspective, you know, kind of innovation, financial, quality, safeguarding, you know, diversity, quotas, you know, should we be providing quotas in and around coaching? And that's what makes the sports industry so dynamic and so kind of interesting. But I think for me, being able to, if I could have one kind of wish out of the sports sector and the people that operate at that kind of C-suite level, is around collaboration and perhaps losing the fear maybe of the commercial angle, and maybe thinking a little bit more about young children and thinking about people that take part in sport, which the vast majority of people that take part in sport are not at the elite level. So having maybe lift their head up and maybe see what's in front of them would be lovely.
Absolutely. Off topic question, Ian. You're currently in the U.S. in Fort Lauderdale, at David Beckham Stadium right there behind you. One of the MLS stadiums. What are your thoughts on the U.S. being a closed system, not having promotion relegation versus where you come from the U.K., where you guys have promotion relegation? Speaking from a perspective of, I'd like to get two sides of your perspective on an investment standpoint to a fan perspective.
Well, I can speak for my own club here, Millwall, who are teetering on the edge of maybe being relegated from the Championship to League One. Certainly makes it interesting as a fan. There's a hell of a lot kind of riding on it. Promotion and relegation is a thing that has existed in certain sports in certain sort of countries. And, you know, I think from my perspective, it's something, you know, the promotion race and relegation race that happens for clubs is huge. and it's great from a fan perspective. Not so great from a financial perspective for those clubs. And actually, look, what we have to realise here, away from the really big corporate leagues, athletes that play those sports don't make life-changing money, invariably. And relegation can contribute to the financial kind of insecurity and instability of clubs. And that obviously clearly has a knock on their largest expense, which is players and players' contracts, right? So I think it has its place. The concept of no relegation, I think, is kind of interesting. I'm not sure if that was my team, whether and you're kind of teetering around mid to lower table for the rest of the season, but you know you're not going to go down. I'm not sure, because that doesn't happen to my club. We're always kind of either terrible or doing okay. I'm not sure what that does for fan engagement. Like, you know, middle of the season, you're kind of mid to low table. Obviously, the big derby games against your big rivals always have a little bit of extra spice and kind of mean something. But, you know, sport invariably is the business, and businesses need to know where they are and where their balance sheet is going to be at the end of the season, next year, year beyond. You know, whether that means to commit to buying a new stadium or setting up a women's team, which obviously I know not necessarily all of the kind of big teams in the MLS have, and I think that's an interesting question about whether they should, but they can't necessarily plan for that financially if they don't know what they're going to be earning next season. So I think there's pros and cons of both. I think from a fan point of view, I've always grown up with promotion and relegation, but you know, you are speaking to people that, you know, I live in the UK and we have cricket. And trying to explain cricket to somebody from North America that you could play for 5 days and it could be a draw, you know, I don't think we've got all the answers over here in the UK. So, but I think from a franchise position, you know, you've only got to look at the success of franchises in hockey and in football and basketball here in the States. It's worked. I don't know how kind of North American fans feel when they put their life and soul into a team and then they kind of up sticks and move to the other side of the country. From a franchise perspective, that would really hurt me. I think sports clubs have a role within their communities. So I mean, how does that feel? Let me ask you a question, turn your podcast around on you, but how does that feel when you speak to fans who, you know, used to support one team and then they've now moved to California or something? How does that go down?
Yeah, for sure. I'll answer that one quickly. So in regards to, you know, a franchise, you know, in a city that has a stadium and then they end up moving to another stadium, let's say 50, 100 kilometers to a different location to switch to from a pop-up to their home base, so a stadium that they're now owning. That could definitely hurt fans. And change their programming from the location that they were going to now have to transition to another stadium. Again, going back to what you were saying about it hurting, it definitely does hurt. And it's not something that I don't think should be promoted to do, but it does happen. And I don't think it's good either. I agree with you. I think once you have, you know, the community engaged, you want to keep them where they are and you don't want to move them. So I know that is something big in the UK where, you know, I don't know if there's any policies or sanctions in regards to that, but clubs are not able to do that in Europe, I've heard, versus in the US, it's a bit different.
Yeah, I think it's more, you know, it's around fans and who owns football, I suppose, if you're looking at soccer, if you're looking like that, who actually owns soccer? You know, the fans that go, the people that buy the merchandise, the people that buy the TV subscriptions, etc. You know, without them, you don't, you know, soccer doesn't have the product that it has. So it's about trying to influence and make sure that the people that are running kind of sport at the highest level, not just soccer, but its highest level, of course you want it to, you know, it has to financially stack up. I understand that. But, you know, the other side of it, don't forget the people that pay the wages. Don't forget the people that kind of have supported that club, you know, lifelong, you know. So my roots back to Millwall, I absolutely could have supported a team that had some glory. You know, I was the only person in the playground as a young kid wearing the Mule shirt, but you know, my dad supported them, and he was born in 1947, supported them since he was a young lad. His dad in the war when the ground was bombed in London in the war, helped clear the pitch of rubble. You know, those ties to clubs run really deep. You might have seen, I don't know if you followed the kind of furore about big European clubs wanting to set up a European Super League. But, you know, from a fan's perspective, they don't want that. They want to see Arsenal play Tottenham, and they want to see that rivalry, and they want to see Liverpool and Manchester United. They don't want to go to an away game and have to travel to Barcelona for it. Now, that's great in a European competition, but they want to see football as they've kind of known it. And sometimes the change is good, don't get me wrong, but you know, too much change and too many kind of elaborate ideas, that because it's invariably around cash. You know, I'm a firm believer in talking to your fans. What do they actually want, rather than perhaps just what makes financial sense.
Absolutely. Omnia Sports Group seems to emphasize a lot on innovation and technology in sports. Could you elaborate on some of the cutting edge projects or initiatives you guys are involved with?
Yes, I mentioned PowerPlay earlier, PowerPlay the Future, and that, as I said, is around bringing investors and female founders together. And that, you know, that isn't always about cash. That isn't, you know, some ideas, male and female, are not kind of pitch ready. They're not at the point where they can go and stand in front of investors and ask and put their ask in. They might have a fantastic idea, fantastic concept. But you know, they might be a creative individual. They may not have the first idea how to set up an app, or you know, might need some support from a legal perspective. And there's so many big companies and brands out there that do want to give something back. You know, have had a leg up at some point in their career by someone helping them, guiding them, being a mentor for them, supporting them, being a critical friend, so to speak. So from us, from a PowerPlay perspective, I think the, you know, technology and innovation is huge, right? You know, I mentioned earlier about boots. You look at wearables, you look at sports watches, you look at kit. You know, you look at data analytics, esports, how sports engage with fans. Technology is massive within the sports space. It's not getting any smaller. It's huge. You know, every kind of big brand would like to catch the next wave. But from a kind of technology point of view, and from Omnia Sports Group, us just trying to ensure that women have an equal kind of access to that room. And you know, we don't want any money out of that. That's not why we do it. But being able to put female founders in a room with people that can invest, you know, whether that's from a venture capitalist or angel investors, etc. But those kind of areas, I suppose, around technology is massive. I mean, I saw in the news today that Jake Paul's supposed to be fighting Mike Tyson, broadcast on Netflix. You know, that will probably make him one of, if not probably the highest paid, you know, combat sports individual for that year that streams. There'll be a behind the scenes documentary leading into it. It'll be marketing everywhere. And no offense to Adam Sandler, but if Adam Sandler can be the best paid actor in the world because of Netflix, then you know that's going to do something for sport. So you know, technology innovation, it's not going anywhere. It's something that you have to embrace. I think from sports themselves, from a federation perspective, and also individuals understanding their commercial value and what they bring, and how that could be commercialized. Like I said, lots of athletes don't make life changing money. So being in a position, you know, to innovate and have people in and around you that can help you, you know, put you in touch with, I suppose, individuals that can turn your idea or your seed idea or your concept or your technology into a reality. I think the difficulty is a good thing, but the difficulty is them having access. You know, the really worrying stuff sometimes that we hear is that women are having to give their idea to a man to go and present because they're more likely to get investment. You know, that just feels wholeheartedly wrong. And you know, from our position, those cutting edge projects, the things that don't exist yet, the things that could be next, the things that would take fan engagement and esports and everything else to the kind of next level. I think the I think the big banks and the commercial sort of finance houses, so to speak, they understand the direction of travel. They understand how much money could be made. And I think for the individual, making decisions about who to go with, that can be tough. So that's kind of why, Powerplay exists. But from a technology point of view, I don't know if you watch Formula One, but if you watch Formula One racing sort of 10 years ago and look at it now and hear what they say in the cockpit, you can see the analytics, the rev counter, the speed, just see everything, can see so much. And I see that only kind of progressing, because that's what fans want. They want that stuff. They want to be behind the scenes. They want to kind of have all access to all areas, to see everything, to see the insight and the life of athletes and sports stars. My son going to PSG, like I said the other day, he wanted to go and see where Mbappe trains, and he wanted to see where Mbappe puts his bum in the changing rooms. Like, we want that. But this is the kind of the electronic and the technological kind of access to sport that we all crave. It's a really, really interesting space.
Absolutely. In regards to investment, are you guys only investing in women and only technology projects?
No. Anything that kind of dovetails with social change. That could be coaching, that could be officiating. Our brand around everything in sport this year is all around women's editions. For us, it's I think the thing with, there's lots of money out there, right? And there's lots of people that are willing to invest, but are they investing a bit because their values, or do your values align? Do you actually want to work with that brand? What do they stand for? What are they interested in? What's their why? Why are they doing it? For us, I think from a social change perspective, being able to make sports safer, being able to ensure that sport's regulated, but ensuring that, marginalized communities are able to engage in sport. I mentioned netball earlier, which obviously is not necessarily big here in North America, but in Australia and New Zealand and the UK, netball's big. It's predominantly a sport for women and girls through the national curriculum. I mentioned netball in Norway, and I've got some strange looks that they've definitely not heard of netball. There wasn't a back to netball club 50 miles from where my wife lives. So actually there'd be no commercial aspect for us as a company to kind of do that, but it's the right thing to do. Why is that not happening? And being able to challenge sports federations to kind of do the right thing sometimes has commercial sense, and other times it won't make any money at all. But from our perspective, investing and working in spaces that have long and meaningful social change is what we do and why we do.
So, Ian, what advice would you offer to aspiring professionals looking to carve a niche in sports, especially in an executive role?
Okay. So, like I said earlier, that athletes invariably, depending on their nature of their sport, don't make life-changing money. And a lot of athletes' careers will end and finish not at a moment of their choosing, injury, deselection, etc. So I think the really important thing as an athlete is understanding your worth. Firstly, athletes make, in my view, fantastic employees. They're hardworking, they're tenacious, they have drive, they're organized. And sometimes you can feel, because you've been a professional athlete or an athlete in general, that that you've kind of neglected other parts of your CV or other parts of your kind of work history, that you might have gaps. But actually, those are skills and things that you can't invariably teach, and employers really struggle to find. So there's a fantastic charity here that operate in the UK called Switch to Play. I keep saying here like I'm in the UK and then I see outside, but they kind of try and work with athletes before they sort of transition, before their career sort of comes to an end. So not every athlete wants to end up on kind of celebrity kind of go dancing on ice and all this kind of stuff. That's not necessarily a space that people want to go into. So being able to plan for your next steps and understanding information around kind of brand and marketing awareness, there's no It's not a sign of any weakness to not understand something. You know, go out and poke your nose in that space and try and educate yourself. But I think the really important thing is what drives you? What values do you have? What do you actually want to do? What are you interested in? You know, get yourself a mentor. You know, the world owes you no favors. And me working with young children invariably and sort of teenagers, they kind of leave education thinking the world owes them a favor and the world's standing on its arms out. And we know that that's not the case. So, you know, being able to kind of think that it's okay not to know what you want to go and do next, I think that's okay, and not to sort of suffer on your own. The future role that you might want might not even exist yet. I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago that we'd be talking about esports in the way that we're talking about it, or certain technologies or streaming services, things like that. So, you know, it's okay. That's the first thing. But education has to be the key here. You know, understanding of where you want to go, how you're going to get there, who's doing the job that you want to do, how did they get there, what mistakes did they make, what could you learn? And education shouldn't stop. It should be diverse. It should be so you can become, you know, a well-rounded person as possible. Put your head in spaces, never say no to anything. You know, pay it forward. You never know when that person may be in a role that can support you, or you might be in a position to be able to support them. And, you know, there's a really good example of a non-league footballer that I met recently, a guy called Toby Show Silva, plays, is a striker coming perhaps towards the end of his career. And he's sort of planning for what's next. And he's gone and done his master's degree, and he's putting himself in situations and with events and around people that he never would have done normally, because, you know, he doesn't really know what's next, but you never quite know what you're going to kind of stumble into. Surround yourself, you know, with good people, people that you feel that do have your best interests at heart. And I suppose the big thing for me is I don't think anyone in life knows 100% what's next. You just have to be 51% sure. So, you know, if you're an athlete, you know, or a professional sports star, whether you're a sports professional or not, thinking about what's next is very difficult to do when you're young, because you're living the thing that you want it to be, right? The thing that you've trained for. But it's not going to last forever. And that duty of care aspect is one thing that we'll be raising over our 24 series, because I think the duty of care to athletes, their space, I think it could be really patchy depending on the sport. And effectively, if you're deselected or you're injured or you're no good anymore, you're out. And where do those people go? You know, you've trained for something, it's all you know, and all of a sudden you're not doing it anymore. And the impact that can have on athletes is huge. So being in a position to kind of have some ideas maybe around what could be next, go and experience those. As I say, get yourself a mentor, go and put your head in those spaces. And you might go and see it and think this isn't for me, I don't like that, but that's still positive. That's still a positive thing. As I said, you know, coming back to people knowing their value, athletes are by their very nature, you know, sometimes a bit grumpy because they're so driven and they know what they want. But actually, in the workplace, that's you can't teach that. So, you know, for me, I think any type of niche within an industry, it normally relies on people being able to support you and give you a leg up and help. So, you know, if you're an athlete and you're kind of mid-career and you want to get into media, what contacts do you have? You know, contacts are contracts. It's a bit true, but it's true. And relationships are really, really important in that. So put yourself out there, and you don't know what you don't know. You've got to be out there to go and do that. So. Yeah, tough space. And a shameless plug for Switch to Play. Have a look at Switch to Play Foundation, great charity in the UK. Really, really difficult space to operate in as a charity. People are very emotionally connected to charities for different reasons, you know, cancer, children's charities, etc. When you talk about the plight of an athlete, it doesn't tend to pull on the heartstrings of people in relation to other charities. But you know, the mental health impact of being injured, deselected, not making the team are huge for athletes. And I don't think people champion their cause enough.
Absolutely. Well, Ian, thank you so much for sharing that. You know, there's a lot of points that I really resonated with you. What you mentioned, finding a mentor, you know, going out, testing the waters, you know, seeing if you like it or not. And and really getting keyed in, really focused in on what you really do want to do. And you shared a lot of great perspectives there. With saying that, there was something I was going to ask you, but I'm just forgetting it right now because I'm just thinking about so many different things at this time. But okay, I'll just put the plug in. How can the viewers and listeners get connected for the event tomorrow on a live stream? And where can they get tickets in regards to the next events that are coming up?
Yeah, well, unless you live in Fort Lauderdale, it's probably going to be a bit difficult for people to get here in person tomorrow. But if you go on the Everything in Sport website, and you'll see a link for our events, and you'll be able to get yourself registered, and we'll send the link will come out to you. Failing that, we've got it'll be broadcast out on YouTube as well. So again, you can Google that, and all our kind of link tree is on our website. But you know, if you're in North America, we're hitting Montreal in June. And if you want to come along, and you'd be more than welcome. Hopefully we'll get you there, Kareem, as well. Get you flying over to the other side. Well, how was it? 45-minute flight? It's not to Montreal for you?
About that, an hour. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can handle that. You're a big boy. You can do that.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, Ian, thank you so much for taking the time today. For being on the One Soccer Nation podcast.
No worries. Thanks for having me.